delighted to be joined today by former government minister Dan Meridor of the formerly of the Likud party. I'll give a, for those of you that are listeners that don't know, but I'm sure many of you will, Dan Meridor has a long and prestigious career in Israeli politics. He has served a range of government portfolios, including the justice minister and also finance minister in Netanyahu's first government in the 90s. And in the last decade, he also served again in Netanyahu's second government from 2009 to 2013 as a senior minister inside the security cabinet as well. So, former Minister Dan Meridor, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Good to be with you.
So if I can start, I mean, I want to ask a range of questions, both dealing with some history and also kind of some current events in the issues that we have now around the formation of the government. But if I could just start off with a deep in going back to a little bit of history. You served as a justice minister when you were a young man in your early 40s. If I can ask you, what was that like serving as a government minister as a young man? And when you were serving in the justice ministry, what were your biggest challenges and maybe the toughest decisions that you had to make at the time?
I became minister of justice in 1988, and I was 41 years of age, and I served there about 4 years in two consecutive governments, led by Yitzhak Shamir, prime minister. The first government was a national unity government with the Labour, second without them when they moved out of the government. Well, this was for me a unique experience as I'm a lawyer and I love the law. And I had this position in which I could have some influence on the Israel legal system, which was not yet in order in the following sense. We have, you may know, no constitution in a written document. And we have basic laws. And I thought that what I would try to do is to introduce and legislate basic laws that are protecting human rights. We had basic laws about the institutions, the Knesset, the government, the president, and so forth, but nothing about human rights. And in an attempt that took almost the 3 years more, we ended up not with the full legislation that I wanted. There was a crisis in the middle, but we had introduced in 1992 the basic laws of human rights, which gave the Supreme Court the authority to have an overview and judicial review over Knesset laws, and entrenched in the Israeli constitutional legal system the basic laws of human liberty and dignity. This was important, I thought, and there was, of course, the attempt to find the right balance between the national cause, especially the security challenges, and human rights, what pertains to the public, to the general, and what pertains to the individual. And as our party, the Likud party, used to be by its name, national liberal movement, both national and liberal, not only national, not only liberal, but the balance between the two. This was, to me, the guiding line. How do I do that right? So we fought for human rights and in endorsing and human rights international conventions with the Israeli government, and then did and when I was Minister of Justice. And we fought for the security services to keep in line with the moral and legal parameters when they investigate. And to see that the Israeli army, when they were fighting a very important war against the Intifada, do it within the rules and don't exceed. So this was one major element. And the other thing, of course, was the standing of the Supreme Court of Israel, which was for years very, very prestigious and high, to keep it and to keep the legal system, judicial system working as well. So we had 4 very interesting years. The Prime Minister, Shamir, with whom I worked very closely, was a very, I thought, a very good prime minister. And we had very good connection, full confidence and openness. And together, under his leadership, we did a lot in the legal system. The other challenge that was there, you may remember, in the late 80s, beginning of 90s, the Soviet Empire began to collapse. The Jews began to come out, let my people go. And this was a huge challenge for the Israeli cabinet, of which I was a member, of course. How do we absorb into us In fact, something exposed, I can say, about 1 million people, the population that was about 4 million then, or 5 million. It was a huge task, of course, challenges in the welfare area, in the business area, occupation and housing and whatnot. And this was a major challenge, which was very uplifting, the spirit. We did what Israel is built for, the raison d'etre of a Jewish state, to let Jews come home to their historic homeland. So this is another challenge all of us took part in. I especially took a lot of interest and took part in that, that. So this was the 4 years, practically 4 years, that I was Minister of Justice from late 88 to mid 1992.
So I wanted to jump to the present day, because today we also have a justice minister who also is in his early 40s from the Likud party, also with a legal background. And just this week we've seen some quite controversial decisions. Firstly, when he was closing down the courts as a method to basically prevent the trial of the prime minister. I wonder if you could comment on kind of the current minister and the legal issues, and also if I can add to that the other issue we saw this week of the unprecedented closing down of the Knesset, and as you related to your issues of dealing with the balance of the judicial review by the High Court, how you see these issues playing out today?
Well, the Mr. Ohana, who was appointed Minister of Justice by Prime Minister Netanyahu some months ago, is more or less the opposite of what I was. I worked for strengthening the Supreme Court and the legal and judiciary system and human rights. He acts openly, the opposite direction. And I don't agree with that at all. This is why I'm now talking with you rather than sitting in the cabinet. The Likud party, which, as I told you, was the party that defended the Supreme Court, the Menachem Begin, my mentor, was a great defender of the Supreme Court and human rights, alongside being a very national person. The national Jewish Zionist cause was the main thing in his life. So it's always balanced by democracy and liberal values. Today, it's the opposite. And we saw this crisis that you just mentioned. The prime minister is standing trial. There were accusations, there were suspicions and accusations. And he thought that there will nothing come out of it. He thought the police will not find anything. They did. And then he thought the attorney general will not indict him because he appointed him. Still, he indicted him for bribery and two other serious charges. And then he thought that he could get immunity from the Knesset, and they couldn't get the majority for this. So the trial was set for 2 or 3 days ago. And they found a way, can I say, they did not invent the coronavirus crisis. This is not their invention, of course, but they used it in a way that did not allow the court to sit and have a plea on Mr. Netanyahu's charges. And this is a shadow overhanging everything else here. And then I think there is a huge problem that one needs to see in the context of the coronavirus. No doubt, coronavirus is of major concern to all of us, all over the world, Britain, as in Israel and other countries. The uncertainty is immense. The span between the good outcome and apocalyptic visions is very wide, and people are quite anxious, I think, with good reason. So people's minds are not set now on issues of democracy. They are more set on how do we cross this stormy river, which is very dangerous, and we don't know yet. So I thought that for a leadership that is faced with such a challenge, of course, there are decisions to be made, but the last thing they need to do is to get hysterical and to get into panic. And I think things need to be done with caution and with, can I say, cold thinking, not hot emotions. And they should not use it to have political gains. This was not the case here. And the fact that they closed down the courts but for urgent things, I think, was exaggerated. And if I were the prime minister, I would say, okay, we need to do that, but my trial would be held on time, not to raise the suspicion that it was another way not to stand trial. They didn't do it, and the court case is now postponed for at least 2 months. Who knows what comes later? Then they didn't want very much, I think, Knesset supervision, because in the Knesset, the last election, Netanyahu stood, not personally, to the Likud party, but the issue was Netanyahu yes and Netanyahu no. And the A's had 58 and the N's had 62. He did not get the majority, he was minority. So the Knesset is against him. 62 don't vote for him, 58 do. So it is true that no other member has an easy way to form a government, including Mr. Gantz. But Netanyahu didn't gain the majority. So he didn't want the Knesset, I think, to operate properly. So they, the speaker of the Knesset, Mr. Edelstein, himself a hero fighting the Soviet Union, a man I know and I appreciate, took wrong decision by not allowing the Knesset to elect a new speaker, which he should have done. And do not allow the Knesset now to, did not allow the Knesset to start functioning. So there was an appeal to the Supreme Court of Justice, the High Court of Justice, and I think the justice has been, the case has been heard yesterday and will be, I think, heard again on Sunday. I think they will have to yield and the Knesset will reconvene and start its work and establishing the committees and so forth. So this is the issue that one needs to remember. Yes, we are in a crisis. The crisis needs to be tackled. It's a serious one, not easy, but this should not come at the expense of basic democratic values and basic democratic institutions, like the independence of the court and the functioning of the court, and the independence, of course, in functioning of the Knesset. The Knesset, the British Parliament, is above the government, not below the government. The government is subordinate to the Knesset. So they should act, I hope they will, in a decisive way to allow us to continue to be a democracy, which is very important, alongside fighting this virus, which is quite alarming to all of us.
Absolutely. In parallel to this process, we also have the idea that of negotiations going along to form a coalition, possibly even as we're hearing recently of renewed hopes of a national unity government. As someone that's been in that role before, could you give our listeners a flavour of what it's like in the room to be negotiating to try and build a coalition?
Well, in normal times, parties. No party has a full majority. So they need partnership. They need coalition with some parties. We don't have a bipartisan system, which Britain used to have and America has. We have multi-party system. So the building a coalition is something that we are used to, and we do it since 1948, since the establishment of Israel in 1949. And the government were very strong and did very good things while being coalition governments, and there were others who did the poor thing because they were poor, not because of the system, because of the people and the parties involved. This time, Netanyahu has not been able in the three last consecutive elections of last year to get a majority for himself and his natural partner, the Orthodox and the extreme right. He can't have it. The other guys, led by Kahol Lavan, blue and white, headed by Gantz, seem to have it very difficult. And it's not clear that they can have a government because there are huge differences among them, from the extreme Arab nationalist part of them to the more moderate Arabs, all the way to people on the very left side of the political spectrum. They're all against Bibi, but can they build a government? Not easy as well. So this being the case, one possible outcome is a joining hands between Likud and Kahol Lavan, what we call national unity government. But there are certain issues that need to be resolved. What about Netanyahu's trial? Will it go on or will he try to evade it? If he tries to escape it, I don't think there will be a government. I hope not. If not, how does he function as prime minister when there is a defendant in a criminal case for bribe? Big question that is left unanswered now. What about the policy regarding annexation, the Trump's plan, other things? So need to agree on this and, of course, on sharing the power in the government. So there are negotiations. Will they agree in the end or not? It's still unclear.
Indeed. You mentioned the Arab parties. How do you relate to the current discourse, and what do you see the role that should be for the Israeli Arab parties, the joint list in the Knesset?
Israel is the national home of the Jewish people. It was built by the UN resolution calling for a Jewish state neighboring an Arab state. So it is a Jewish state in that sense, that the Jews are a majority, that it's our expression of self-determination as a Jewish people. But it is not a state made only of Jews. It's a state made of Jews, around 80%, and Arabs, around 20%. And this is fine. We never thought of one race country. So it's a racist idea. We knew Arabs live here. We want to have majority, so the country will be basically will appeal to Jews as their basic homeland, historic, and so forth. And we can have a flag that has the Magen David on it. Like in a way in Britain, you have a flag that has a cross on it, although Jews live in England. So Arabs live in Israel, and they will have to accept that there is a Magen David on the flag and so forth. But we need to, having won the battle over the land of Israel in 48 and after that, we need to have the magnanimity of the winner, not the stingy attitude of somebody who doesn't care about the minority. We need to be forthcoming to the Arab population. They are 20% of us, more or less. Most of them feel Arab, feel Muslim, but feel Israeli as well. And we should accept it. There are Israelis who are Jews, 80%. Israelis who are Arabs, 20%. And they have full equal rights with us, voting like we do and so forth. And it's our role as the majority to treat the minority the way we Jews wanted to be treated when we are minorities all over the world. So, yes, there are some of them who are very extreme on the edges of the Arab society. In the political leadership, more people are more extreme. But one needs to find a way to coalesce with them and keep them in the circle of the parliament, government, and the system of the state. This doesn't mean that we need to not to fight for our defense and security, but don't make all the Arabs enemies. They are not. Don't alienate them. Try to incorporate them. The recent election, unfortunately, there were tones that sounded very, very ugly. They never said the Arabs. They said the list of the Arabs, but there was some flavor that felt very reminiscent of old times against the Jews. I don't like it. So the Jews against the Arabs is about the values and the ways that we need to choose. And the Arabs are legitimate partners. We can't coalesce with parties that don't agree with us, whether they're Arab or Jewish. But don't make it a Jewish-Arab story. It is not that case. So in the Arab, I know many of the Arab members of the Knesset, they served with me. Some of them are good people, and we don't agree on many things, but we can work together. Some of them, I don't agree at all, and we can't work together. So don't make all of them one herd of sheep. They are different people with different ideas.
If I can ask you now, I mean, you have spent in your political career many hours with Prime Minister Netanyahu. You served as his finance minister in his first government. He brought you back in during his second government to a senior ministerial portfolio. How do you assess his current behaviour? And although we don't know how much longer he will continue to serve for, at this point, what would you say is his legacy that he's leaving?
I think the question of his legacy is bothering very much because of the criminal charges. If in the end he stands trial, as he should, because this is where he stands now, he doesn't escape it. He knows there's a chance that he'll be either acquitted or convicted. If he's acquitted, fine. But if he's convicted, and I don't know, he has the presumption of innocence, of course, then the legacy will have this very heavy shadow on it. Somebody who might have ended up not in his home, but somewhere else, as it happened to Mr. Olmert and so forth, and Mr. Katsav as president. So I think this is looming over his thinking very much. And he does want to end this way. And maybe some of the things we are seeing is his fight to avoid this course of action that is seemingly going to happen, unless he stops the trial, which he shouldn't be able to. So he's caught in a very difficult position. His lawyer, his past lawyer who passed away some months ago, Mr. Weinroth, offered him to go for a plea bargain. He didn't want to do that. So here is a major issue that I think is in the back of the mind, or in the fore of the mind, of Mr. Netanyahu. Other than that, of course, he's a very talented politician. He has a very good capability in convincing people, I would say, the American way, not that much the British way, but he talks in soundbited way, and he knows how to do it, and people listen to him, English and Hebrew. And he has a host of people, I would say 25% of the country, that votes for him again and again. Now they got 36 members. It's 26-27%, and many other segments in the religious orthodox parties and others want him as a prime minister. So he has this achievement. Israel is doing well generally, and he has a role that he played well in that. The Israeli economy is doing well. I don't speak of this crisis, but until this crisis. Science, Israel education. Israel is a huge success story. He's not the only one. There are many people who contribute to that, prime ministers, ministers, others, the civil society. But basically, he has played a role that has positive aspects in it. On the issue of the Palestinian story, I think he makes a mistake, because his policy will lead us to a position of one state, in fact, no border between the River Jordan and the sea. In that, if that is the case, we don't easily have majority. It's going to be by national state, and we need to try to separate. That we don't have peace is not his fault, because others who try to have peace, like Barak, no, but couldn't get it. The other side didn't do the right things, and we couldn't have it. But do we need to continue settlement policy and really making one mess of the whole land, which is basically our historic homeland? But is it our future? Is a big mistake, I thought. But basically, in his mind, again, a smart person, in the end, I think, where I differ from him, it's a political question. Do I lose or gain in politics? And if he sees that it may jeopardize his political position, he may not take the choice that I would have taken, and he will stand.
Can I just ask a question about the current coronavirus plague and wave that we're experiencing? One of the criticisms here that has been talked about in the Israeli media is the lack of long-term strategic planning vis-a-vis the amount of hospital beds available, etc. As someone that was kind of part of the building the Israeli security doctrine over the last decade, do you think this criticism is accurate? Is there more that the government could have done, or was this kind of scenario impossible to foresee?
Well, there are two different things. Yes, I think the government did not finance, did underfinance the health system, which is a very good health system in Israel, one of the best in the world. Public service, very good. It is true, I think they should have given more money, but it has nothing to do with the present crisis. Even if they had more money, if the government gave them more for their budget, which they demanded and they didn't get, and maybe they deserved it. What happens now is something nobody foresaw, nobody could have foreseen, nobody could have prepared for such a demand for ventilators, for masks, for kits, for checking and for testing. It's a plague in a way. It's a pandemic situation that nobody did see or could see, and you can't prepare for such a quick, dramatic change in the needs. So really, one of the major tests that we and England and everybody else stands is how do we have enough in terms of staff, in terms of equipment, to treat the very ill who may not survive if we don't treat them. And this this is a huge problem. You see it happen in Italy. I look through television on what happened in the United States, a very rich country. Same outcry from every hospital. We don't have enough of this, of that. And they are much richer than all of us together. So I don't think anybody could have prepared everything. Of course, you could have done better. And even now, planning should be done very meticulously and very, very well informed, and taking the right risk management that is needed here. But the fact that there is such a huge problem could not have been foreseen or subsidized or being or planned for in the past.
One last question, if I may. I mean, without talking to you with your expertise in other kind of regional security issues or kind of coronavirus aside, I wonder if you could just say comment on what you think of the latest assessment in kind of post the Soleimani assassination, how you assess Iranians, both their nuclear ambition and their role of entrenchment in Syria and the threat that they pose with the proxies on Israel's borders.
Well, I started saying that I think now Iran is very much bothered with the coronavirus. They are one of the countries that are worst affected. And I think the last thing of their mind is what to do with Israel now. They need to survive as a regime, as a country, which all of us have to. So I think the focus has changed very much because of last month's development. But leaving that aside, which I can't because this is what we are experiencing, yes, Iran posed a danger to Israel by trying to get nuclear, by subsidizing and financing and guiding terror groups like Hezbollah, like Islamic Jihad, now helping Hamas and others, and by its ideology that it says Israel has no right to exist. So this combination is quite of concern, of course. I think we dealt quite well with the nuclear story. I would give credit to people don't give credit to, it's President Obama. I think he could have had a better deal. I think they were too hasty and didn't give enough time to get a better agreement. But the agreement they got was under heavy pressure of economic sanctions and political and diplomatic sanctions that really isolated Iran and put it under pressure. They had to agree to do away and destroy many of the things they have already done. And I think it was more or less a good deal. The Prime Minister didn't think so, and he convinced President Trump to walk away from the deal, which is, I think, unprecedented. So I don't know where we stand now, but I think Iran is now in a different world because of the coronavirus. So the nuclear thing needs to be taken care of, definitely, and I hope they will find a way to renegotiate an agreement or something. This is one thing. The terror story and the Syrian story. Yes, Iran tries to build their own coalition within the Muslim world, including in it Syria and Lebanon. They have a hand or a foot in Yemen. It's a danger, and we need to fight it. I think that there is a struggle, which is quite intensive. There used to be, at least until last month or last week. And we need to stand up to them. And then in the end, if you stand up to them, don't flatter them, don't be weak to them, be strong with them. Maybe there's a way to get even an agreement with them, but not from point of weakness, but the understanding that, yes, you may be a strong country, Iran. We are not weaker. We may be even stronger. Both of us are strong powers in the Middle East. Can we have some understanding, some modus vivendi? Maybe not. So with Iran, it's not an easy question, but I think we are strong enough and hopefully smart enough to deal with it.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for that. And thank you very much for speaking to me today. Very much appreciate all your insights. And I hope you stay safe and see through this phenomenon that we're all experiencing.
All the same to you and full health and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you very much. Take care.